speak here, the worshipers? Where's all of my praises? I want everybody around the world to put your hands together because all the praise belongs to God. Here we go.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. I don't have a guest because I'm going to do some commentaries. Late at night and early in the morning, I think on the issues that I believe are not being addressed or addressed fairly. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. Having taught in universities and colleges for my entire adult life, I'm concerned with what is happening to our educational system. And I know that a lot of the teachers in this audience and professors are also concerned. But we do not hear from them. We hear from those who have acquiesced or are part of the problem, where the students, not all students by any means, in fact, probably a very small percentage of students, are challenging everything about education. So we're going to present what their point of view is and then a person who tried to make a difference and what happened to him at Evergreen College. Also today, we'll be looking at how accurate are all these scientific journals, and especially the more scholarly ones, the more prestigious ones, the ones that activists, frequently some of the activists who are in the extreme position, use to justify what they're doing. Well, they use these academic journals. Well, the science says, well, what if the science is wrong? We're going to present information from two professors about how a massive hoax exposes social justice in academia. And then you'll be hearing from Professor Brett Weinstein, a very responsible person, grew up liberal, and look at what happens when he tries to engage in free speech in a place that doesn't want to hear it. Also, I wanted to play a clip because it gives different points of view, especially between two women on gender issues, on the so-called smart arguments for gender-fluid person. This is an interesting argument that you hear. It's worth listening to. And what's happening with most people's beliefs on these issues, especially when the Sherpa, and I found the clip, actually says that you should, the liberal Sherpa woman says that we should never use the word man or men again, it infuses them with a male toxic reactions, and that we should be more feminizing little boys, and that men who are acting masculine or acting the way that some women don't want them to act are toxic to all of society. This is the same person who said that you should ask a baby's permission before you change his diapers. That's how far and extreme some people are willing to go. And instead of being challenged for the stupidity of this, people say, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Makes sense? It makes no sense. It's stupid. But we'll deconstruct it. Then we'll have you share your input with us as well. So we have a very interesting show today. And of course, we always begin with the latest on health and healing. This comes from Queen's University, which is in Belfast in Ireland. It's about a heart-healthy diet in early adulthood is linked to better brain function in middle age. Now, you have to look at the diet in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, and Great Britain. None of those diets are healthy. The most unhealthy would be Scotland and then Ireland and Wales. Ireland's a little healthier, and Wales and Great Britain are really bad diets. The healthiest diet over there in that area of the world would be on the Western Mediterranean, which would be Spain. They have the longest lifespan, by the way, in the world now. They pass the Japanese. But also the healthiest island in the world is Crete. They're the longest-lived people per population in the world. And if you've ever been to Crete, if you've ever been in that area of the world, you know that there's a lot of fruits and vegetables, lots of nuts and seeds, slow eating, slow living. They don't get all stressed out. Family is very important. Being able to have people in your life that you love and trust and respect. The older you get, the more important you become. Now, those are just basic family values that I subscribe to because I saw how it worked where I grew up and how it didn't work in a lot of my friends. One friend in particular who didn't want to take the time to go to the farmer's market or health food store and buy really healthy food and prepare it. So whatever was convenient. And I can't tell you how many times I dropped by my friend's house and there'd be pizza. That was dinner, pizza. That they'd, why are you serving pizza? You know your daughter has an allergy to dairy. Look at her eyes. Her eyes are all puffy. She's always mucousy. She's always blowing her nose. She's got inner ear infections. She's always got gastrointestinal and bloating. And the answer would be, well, there's too many responsibilities. So I just don't have the time to, you know, prepare a meal. But do you have the time to take her to the doctor, to the allergist? Do you have time for all the time she misses from school? I mean, where in being a responsible parent, being intentionally aware of cause and effect is a part of that. In other cultures, in other countries, there are always eyes on you from your family watching and hoping that you learn the transitions of life and how to be a constructive member. In the United States, it doesn't work that way. And the parents who think that they're doing a good job are almost always suffocating their child. Child has no identity. Children are confused. Children are sad. Children don't know who they are, where they belong. So they don't have to worry about that. The parent will protect them. In fact, it's so insane today that you could be arrested and go to jail if you allow your child to walk to school, even if school's two blocks away. This is how ridiculously overprotective we become. And everything is justified by these, you know, helicopter parents, the professional parents. In any case, they're not feeding their children good diets. No one has time to really plan their day where exercise and stress management and eating right and working out a day is just, here's a to-do list, get as much of this done as you can, and it doesn't matter how you do it, just get it done. So eating is not a big deal on the diet. As a result, the conditions that come from not eating, obesity, diabetes, in older adults, dementia, Alzheimer's, heart disease, these are simply accepted as the normal part of life. They are not. So eating a diet that's rich in fruits and vegetables and nuts and seeds, even fish, and low or eliminating meat and dairy products is associated with better cognitive performance when you're in your middle age years, if you have this as a, when you're younger years. And yet America has some of the most unhealthy children in the world. In fact, we have the most adult diabetes in children of any country per population in the world, including India and China. And that says something, because they have a population that's four times larger than ours, each country. This is according to the American Academy of Neurology, published in the journal Neurology. Quote, our findings indicate that maintaining good dietary practices throughout adulthood can help preserve brain health at midlife. And so they studied 2,621 people, average age 25 at the start. They were followed for 30 years. And those who had more of a healthy plant-based Mediterranean diet, whole grains, nuts and seeds, legumes, tubers, and limited their intake of meat and poultry and dairy, they did the best on all levels. cannabis is now shown, according to Ben-Gurion University in Israel, to be as effective alternative option for palliative treatment of cancer patients. Now, what's that mean? It means that in Israel, cancer is a leading cause of death. Because, quite simply, the Israeli diet is not the healthiest diet in the world. You would think it should be, but it isn't. Now, that it doesn't mean there are not healthy items in the diet, or you couldn't live and be a healthy person. You can. There's a vegan society in Israel. And in fact, I've been in contact over the years with vegan societies all over the world, and they are the healthiest people in every country. But there's a whole lot of fried food. There's a lot of animal proteins, a lot of dairy products, just very unhealthy diet. In any case, that's considered a major problem over there. So palliative care focused on alleviating pain and nausea in patients with advanced stages of cancer. And since 2007, the Israeli Ministry of Health has been approving the use of medical cannabis for the palliative treatment of cancer symptoms. And it's worked. It's made a major difference. So if you are suffering from cancer, and especially advanced cancers, then the cannabis oil can make a big difference in improving how you feel and helping you maintain better digestion and appetite and dealing with pain and nausea. It can help all those conditions. Even if the disease still has the same prognosis and outcome, at least you would not be suffering the same way if you didn't have the opiates, or not the opiates, the cannabinoids from cannabis. So that's important. From Harvard School of Public Health, adding a high-quality plant-based foods to your diet decrease the risk of death from heart disease. I try to keep all the data in the world literature on the relationship between diet and disease. I probably have the largest single repository in the world. And so when I'm sharing information for this broadcast or lectures, books, articles, I'm using what the actual scientific data, as well as my own private personal clinical experiences, have been. And all of the studies, I mean all of them, 100% of all the best studies in the world when it comes to healthy diet show that a healthy diet reduces or prevents disease, and an unhealthy diet increases and worsens disease. I mean, it's really black and white. I mean, on the one side is the science shows that what you eat, you become. So if you're eating bad, your body's going to end up diseasing. On the other hand, good foods also promote good health. So people like to think, well, I eat all right. I mean, occasionally I'll have French fries and soda. How occasionally? Well, only once a day. That's not occasional. It's unfortunately, it's almost every day that Americans are eating diets that cause heart disease, which is the number one medical killer of Americans. And when you add stroke and heart attacks together, you're up to 1 million people, about 450,000 and up to almost 600,000. So this was presented by the American Heart Association's Epidemiology and Prevention Lifestyle Cardiometabolic Health Scientific Session. So remember, not all plant-based diets are equal, but if you select organic and healthy, high-quality plant-based foods, over time, it lowers the risk of death. Even if you started off with a poor diet, you can reverse the conditions. So that's adding to the body of literature. And this one study had 47,983 women in it, and they were nurses, and 35,737 men, and they were physicians. So that's a lot of people. It's almost 70,000 people. And we're looked at over a 12-year follow-up period. And those who ate the most fruits and vegetables lived the longest, didn't have the least amount of heart disease and heart attacks. Also, from St. Louis University comes a study about the Mediterranean diet. Again, that's a principally plant-based diet. Boosts endurance exercise within days. This was published in the Journal of the American College of Nutrition. They found that if you ran a 5K, which is about 3.1 miles, you were able to go faster after eating a Mediterranean diet than if you were eating a Western diet. So the fruits, the vegetables, the nuts, the olive oil, the whole grains, and avoiding the red meat and processed meats and dairy and trans and saturated fats and refined sugars. I've said it many times, but we're not always ready to hear the lessons we need to hear. We can listen to the radio, we can read a book, but if we're not ready to commit ourselves 100% to change, we're not going to change anything. From the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, a diet rich in nuts like almonds is found to improve colon cancer survival. Now, it's just not almonds. Pecans and walnuts have also enormous health benefits. Improve your chances against premature death and cancer reoccurrence. And this was from their Cancer Institute in Boston. They reviewed 800 patients diagnosed with and treated for stage 3 bowel cancer and discovered the positive effect of nuts. And this was a part of the outcome. So what if you just ate nuts on a regular basis? That means you could be preventing a lot of colorectal cancer. Also in the United States, we have about more or less 10 million people, primarily women, on hormone replacement therapy, synthetic hormone replacement therapy. According to the University of Helsinki, which is in Finland, published in the British Medical Journal just today, those who are using this hormone therapy over a period of time, you increase your risk of Alzheimer's disease. That's a big, big problem. Now, there's natural hormone replacement therapy, and that doesn't increase your risk of disease at all. It can alleviate a lot of the problems of hormone imbalance. And finally, Kerman University Medical Sciences in Iran published in the Complementary Therapies and Clinical Practice, women with acute uncomplicated cystitis can benefit from green tea. And green tea is a superfood. Many thousands of studies shows why we should be using it. And now for cystitis, that's just one more reason to use it. And also, if you have diabetic neuropathy, and millions of Americans do, according to Wenshou Medical University in China, coenzyme Q10 eliminates the mitochondrial dysfunction in diabetic neuropathy. And that's a big plus. And so if you want to have less pain, better use, and less more energy in the tissue, coenzyme Q10. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break and come right back into your questions on our question line. And just so you have our line, if you have a question, you can call our voicemail at 862-800-6805. 862-800-6805, and ask your question. If you want to listen live, wherever you're at in America, at noon to 1 Eastern Standard Time, call, write down the number, please, 641-793-7091. 641-793-7091. Back in a moment.
Get it on, 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 get Yes, my name is Hytram Gobin. This is the Gary Null Show. My question is, my son is 16 years old, and he has cystic acne on his face, and I want to know how to naturally get rid of it.
Okay, well, your son is not alone. At 16, he is the perfect age for acne. About 80% of all Americans will have acne at some point, generally between, let's say, their early teens and up to age about 40. And it's a severe inflammatory process. And it occurs when the body has a dramatic increase in its production of androgen, meaning male and sex hormones, and the hormones stimulate the production of keratin, that's a type of protein, and sebum, that's the oil that comes out. And if sebum is secreted faster and it can be moved through the pores, that's where your acne pustule actually occurs. And that's why you have to keep your skin clean at all times, sometimes 2-3 times a day, not with an antibacterial soap, and because that's dangerous for you. And use use some form of sponge that can exfoliate the tissue and, in effect, get out the oils. The key is the oils, because the excess oil is sticky and it is very susceptible to bacteria. And when the bacteria gets in there, you end up with the blackheads when sebum combines with skin pigments and plugs the pores. And you also can have whiteheads. In any case, all this can be dealt with. Women who suffer from premenstrual syndrome will have acne flare-up sometimes, not on all women. That's generally the release of progesterone from ovulation. Now, also, you can, if you're taking birth control pills, those are frequently high in progesterone, and that can cause acne as well. Also, if you're eating sugar, now, even if you don't eat white sugar, high fructose corn syrup and soft drinks, that'll cause it. Glucose will cause it. And also anything that breaks down into sugar, from a complex carbohydrate, a polysaccharide, to a simple sugar, a monosaccharide, would be a white bread or pasta, a pretzel, all these, a potato chip, a french fry. These are all making you very susceptible, because you can end up with candida. And candida can cause hormone changes that encourage the liver to produce unhealthy sebum. So those are some of the conditions. So think of all the things that teenagers eat, and then think of what happens in their body causing hormones. And then imagine that you're just the average person, and you don't realize the skin actually must breathe. What if you're bundled up all the time? What if you're sleeping on the same sheets all the time and blankets? And well, where is the skin supposed to clean itself? It can't. The pores become clogged. And that's when all of the microorganisms, and we have billions of microorganisms and bacteria in our skin. That's why some people have a particular odor. Someone else will have a different odor. Depending upon the type of bacteria you have and the type of sebum that is being secreted is how bad your body will smell. And each part of your body has a different amount of these glands and a different amount of sweat. So what you will have under your arms and your groin and your feet and other parts of your body that tend to have a great deal of sweating, the bacteria is what causes the particular odors. Now, then on top of that, you have to ask, when was the last time you washed your body thoroughly? Not just put some soap on and rinse it off. That's not doing diddly squat. I'm talking about really cleaning the pores, you know, exfoliating. Dirt, dust, oils, grime, we're all faced with it every day. All that clogs your pores. So proper cleaning of the skin and letting the skin breathe. If you live in a warm environment, get out, get in the sun, you know, wear gym shorts, and if you're a woman, a sports bra, and let that body breathe. Sweating is healthy, sweating is good. But then after you sweat, and that's good, you're throwing toxins out of the body along with controlling the body temperature, that's the purpose of sweating. You then clean it and clean it thoroughly. Now, nutritionally, you can also make a big difference. You have to have the right hopefully about 10 to 20 billion probiotics throughout a day in your body's gut. So the health of the intestine will frequently determine whether you have acne. And chromium picenolate, that also reduces infections on the skin. And colloidal silver, just spraying a little colloidal silver over the acne acts as a natural antibiotic. Having good oils like coconut oil, flaxseed oil, primrose oil, that supplies the essential gamma-linolenic acid that you need to keep the skin healthy and tissues repaired. Vitamin A is good for the skin because it strengthens the protective epithelial skin tissue. And then vitamin B complex at 100 milligrams is good. It improves blood flow to the surface of the skin. Vitamin C is terrific for the skin because it helps reduce skin inflammation and produces collagen to repair anything wrong with the skin. Vitamin D3 is good, vitamin E. Garlic, chlorophyll is great for cleansing the blood, preventing infections. It also helps the skin. And then I would look at L-cysteine, C-Y-S-T-E-I-N-E. That contains sulfur, and that's needed for healthy skin. That's why in European countries, if they eat a lot of garlic and onions, well, they have much healthier skin. But you can also get MSM, which is garlic. That's not garlic, it's sulfur. That's good. And so those are the things you can do. And burdock root and dandelion leaves, milk thistle and red clover are all good for acne. Okay, so those are cleansers. Hope that helps. Now, I want to share a few comments on different topics before we go to some of our audio clips. For those living in on the east coast of Florida, I'm filming there, I believe, tomorrow. I have to look at my schedule. I'm filming somewhere, everywhere, every day. And we're wrapping up this very important environmental film I'm working on. And we're filming the leading person in the world on sea rise. That's not all equal. You'll have a greater influx of water coming at night to the east coast than the west coast. So you're going to have massive erosion of the frontal properties, and you're going to lose them. I don't care what you do. There's nothing you can do that's going to prevent the sea from taking back the property that was there, unfortunately, and that's going to cause coastal flooding. It'll race hundreds of billions, even trillions of dollars in value of sea property from sea level rises. And there's an article by Nicholas Kuznets in Inside Climate News, quote, "Rising seas have already eroded coastal property values from Maine to Mississippi by billions of dollars, and the homeowner is losing the value of their property, and hence they don't have the taxes. Without those taxes, local people will not have the money for schools and other ways that the money is used." Quote, "This is a real negative feedback loop, and it's only getting worse. Unfortunately, when I look at a map of the places where the sea level rise is eating into property values, I'm looking all around Florida, the entire coast of Florida, Mississippi, Alabama, up through South Carolina, North Carolina, heavy into Virginia, Maryland, and also over to Delaware. New Jersey is really going to lose value, probably the biggest single state along with Florida. So hurricanes are also going to hit these areas and cause a big mess. So all I can do is bring you the news. My hope is that you don't maladapt to it and simply deny that it's significant or it's not going to happen today and you don't do anything. This is here and now. We just lost 23 people plus hundreds of millions of dollars in damage in Alabama in just an hour over the weekend. It came into a new cycle and was gone. All over the world, we're seeing unique weather events. Australia's had some of the worst wildfires. Some of their historical forests are dried out. I just read an article this morning about that. And unfortunately, this is not going to get better. Australia is a country which is huge, by the way. It's about the same size as the United States in landmass. It is not going to be sustainable for the future. It's just the way it is. I wished it were different. If there was positive news about this, I would tell you. There isn't. So just be aware of that. Also, I wanted to share with you some other interesting information. One is that the measles genetic study, now this is brand new. This is just this morning, and it's about genetic sequencing science breakthrough just proved that measles, quote, outbreaks are caused by the measles vaccine. That's correct. This was published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Clinical Microbiology, and it's entitled Rapid Identification of Measles Virus Vaccine Genotype by Real-Time PCR. And it's discovered that the vaccine, pro-vaccine people have not even been aware of this, that a number of measles outbreaks are actually vaccine reactions from the measles vaccine itself, the MMR vaccine. Quote, from the actual study from the Journal of Clinical Microbiology, and this is the publication of the American Society of Microbiology. You don't get more official than that. Quote, during measles outbreaks, it's important to be able to rapidly distinguish between measles cases and vaccine reactions to avoid unnecessary outbreak response measures such as case isolation and contact investigations. We have developed a real-time reverse transcriptase PCR method specific for genotype A measles virus. So I read the whole article, and what it's saying is they have a breakthrough in identifying, you know, whether you have measles from an original cause or from the vaccine itself. Now, just imagine this. When you're vaccinated with almost anything, you go back to school. You're in school. You think you're protected. You're not. Because you're shedding. When you breathe, it comes out. When you blow your nose, it comes out. When you touch your hand to your nose, it's on your hand. You touch your hand to the desk, to a doorknob. You shake a hand. You've transmitted the measles. And yet that you could shed for weeks. You go home. Everyone in your family's fine. 2 weeks later, they all have the measles because you were shedding. So there's a whole lot that we have not been told that is disingenuous, and we should be. Also, I want to quote Eric Zeus, and this is from the Sacred blog. Why only fools trust America's mainstream news media after the 2003 invasion of Iraq? Quote, I'll just give you a couple paragraphs. Here will be yet another current example to demonstrate that all U.S. mainstream news media hide from their respective publics that the U.S. government is lying. When the U.S. government lies, i.e., that all the mainstream news media in America hide the truth when the government itself is lying. In other words, the U.S. mainstream media are propaganda organs for U.S. government. While some American news media are Democratic Party propagandists and others are Republican Party propagandists, and therefore all of them eagerly expose lies that are of the only partisan nature, none of them will expose lies that both parties share, such as in 2002 and 2003, the central fact at the time, they hid that George W. Bush and his administration were outright lying to the public in each and every instance in which they said that Bush possessed conclusive evidence that, as Bush himself put it on September 7, 2002, and no mainstream and only one alt media exposed it as being a lie. The report came out of the atomic, AEA, that Iraq were 6 months away from developing a nuclear weapon. I don't know what more evidence we need before invading, end quote. That was his answer when he was asked at a press conference on September 7, 2002, Mr. President, can you tell us what conclusive evidence of any nuclear new evidence you have of nuclear weapons capabilities of Saddam Hussein? Quote, immediately, the IAEA said there was no such new report and that the last they were able to find, there was nothing at all left of weapons mass destruction, nor of any ability to make any in Iraq. The American news media simply ignored, in its entirety, the entire American media ignored the IAEA's denial that they had issued in any new report at all, such as Bush had alleged they had issued. Republican news media, like Fox, hid the Bush's allegation, and the Democratic news media likewise hid it. And so the American people trusted Bush and destroyed Iraq. So anyone who says that American invasion didn't vastly harm the Iraqi people is either a liar or else ignorant, and the reality is such as the last two links document. And then aid for Venezuela. The U.S. military planes delivered more than 180 tons of humanitarian aid for Venezuela to the Colombian border city this week, setting up a showdown with Venezuela President Nicolas Maduro, who has vowed to block the supplies. The presumption there is that readers are simply too stupid to wonder, why should I trust that this military plane doesn't also carry weapons for supporters of a coup to overthrow Venezuela's president and to replace him with Trump's choice? Trust that weapons aren't included in the cargo of food and medicine. Is Trump really that some kind of person as to care about the Venezuelan people? Or is this instead yet another U.S. setup for a brutal coup, such as the U.S. did in 1953 in Iran, 54 in Guatemala, and 1973 in Chile, and more recently in the Ukraine in 2014. So what they're saying is, don't trust the media. They lie all the time. Everybody in the media is politicized, and they're ideologied up to the gazoot, so don't believe them. And that's, so I thank them for that. And then one final one. This is from Sarah Gertler, and from Other Words. Quote, criticizing Israel isn't anti-Semitic. Here's what it is. Pro-Israeli politicians don't speak for young Jews like me. They shouldn't pretend to. Weeks ago, when the first accusations of anti-Semitism were being leveled against Representative Omar, I was deeply agitated. Not long ago, I saw her address these accusations at a local town hall. She reminded the world that as a black Muslim woman in America, she knows what hate looks like and spends her life laboring against it. Her words were clear, bold, and unflinching. When members of Congress not only continued to gang up and falsely smear Omar as anti-Semitic, but even created a House resolution painting her words as hateful, I wasn't just agitated, I was absolutely disgusted. Omar has criticized U.S. government support for Israel's actions that break international law, and she's spoken out against the role money in politics plays in shoring up that support. Neither is anti-Semitic. What is anti-Semitic is the cacophony of mainstream media and politicians saying that criticizing U.S. policy towards the state of Israel is the same as attacking Jewish people. Like most American Jewish youth, I grew up knowing Israel. During the holidays, I sang prayers about the land of Israel. In Hebrew school, I learned about the country's culture, its cities, its past prime ministers. At my Jewish summer camp, we started every day with the Israeli national anthem. My image of Israel was a rosy one. When I finally visited it in college, I was spellbound by the lush landscape and sparkling cities, certain I would one day move to this golden ancestral home myself. All this emotional buildup made it all the more sickening when, in the years that followed, I learned the realities of the Israeli occupation. The modern state of Israel was established by Zionists, a nationalist movement started by European Jews with the aim of creating a Jewish state as a refuge for persecuted Jews. It is true that Jews have faced centuries of brutal prosecution in Europe, but the Zionists project shared unmistakably European colonist roots. In 1948, Israel's War of Independence led to the Nakba, an invasion driving 700,000 Palestinians from their homes. These Palestinians were never allowed to return. creating a massive refugee problem that today numbers over 7 million. When I was able to travel freely up and down Israel, the Palestinians who once lived there are legally barred from returning. When I wandered the marketplaces trying stews, Palestinians in Gaza couldn't afford even the gas to cook their food because of the Israeli blockade. Zionism didn't create an inclusive Jewish refuge either. In fact, the diverse Arab-Jewish population that was already thriving in Palestine was pushed out of Israel society as the European Jews became the elite class. What it did create is an imperialist stronghold that continues to break international law by building settlements deeper and deeper into Palestinian territory, giving Jewish Israelis superior legal status to Arab, Israeli, and Palestinians, and attacking all who protest. Since Israel's origin, the U.S. has supplied tens of billions of dollars of military aid and ardent political support. Congress consistently ignores dozens of U.N. resolutions condemning Israel abuses, and year after year gives it more resources to violently oppress impoverished Palestinians. Pro-Israeli lobbying groups, considerable political influence, has even pushed Congress to consider bills punishing Americans who support Palestinian rights. More broadly, they rely on villainization of critics with false claims of anti-Semitism, especially when the criticism comes from a person of color, as we've seen with Angela Davis, Mark Lament Hill, and Michelle Alexander, before Representative Omar. I, along with an increasing number of young American Jews, want to discuss U.S. support of Israel. Talking foreign policy is not anti-Semitism. What is anti-Semitic always is saying that all Jews support violence and imperialism, end quote. So since the mainstream media wouldn't cover that, and I wanted to see how others were covering it, from Sean Hannity, who, Sean should actually dress up like a cheerleader, because I've never seen anyone who's so, it's a cult, this whole fervency on the right and on the left that Israel's the only democratic state, never mentioning any of its extremes and excesses towards the Palestinian people. That does not mean all the people in Israel disdain or want to see the Palestinians destroyed. There is a positive, small, very small, pro-peace movement in Israel. But we just don't talk about it in the United States. So I want to be a voice for the voiceless, because all she's gotten since she made those statements is being attacked. So when we want to get someone who's at least willing to say the truth, shouldn't we at least have the truth said? That said, now let's go to Brett Weinstein testifying before Congress. Now let me set this up. This is on the Evergreen State College riots. I watched a separate homemade video where he was a professor there for a long period of time. Students loved him. He was considered the best teacher at the college, the most popular one. He's a philosopher. And they wanted to make the school different, and he simply asked for dialogue. And I see a video of him just asking peacefully, can we discuss this? And them shouting him down, and then they went looking for him. The police called him and said, there's gangs all over the city looking for you. And he thought, my God, why would they want to be looking for me? What would they do to me if they found me? So this is what happens when you're a true progressive, trying to understand what students want and realizing that there is no room for reasonable, mature conversation against a radical mob. Here's his testimony.
The committee, thank you for the invitation to address you. Tomorrow is the one-year anniversary of the day 50 Evergreen students that I had never met, disrupted my class, accusing me of racism and demanding my resignation. I tried to reason with them. I felt no fear because I knew that whatever my failings might be, bigotry was not among them. At that moment, I felt sure I could reach them. I also felt a moral obligation to try. That racism squanders human potential and erodes human dignity offends me. I am also well-versed in the evolutionary logic that makes racism durable. I should have had no trouble establishing common ground. Their response surprised me. It would take months for me to fully understand what had happened. The protesters had no apparent interest in the very dialogue they seemed to invite. I was even more surprised by the protesters' fervor in shouting down my actual students, some of whom had known me for years. The cruelty and derision reserved for students of color who spoke in my defense was particularly troubling. If not discussion, what did they want? I was one of Evergreen's most popular professors. I had Evergreen's version of tenure. Did they really think they could force my resignation based on a meritless accusation? They did think that, and they were right. What I had not counted on was their alliance with Evergreen's new president. Though the protesters openly humiliated him, the president of the college partnered with the mob in private, handing them concession after concession. We know this because the rioters filmed everything and proudly uploaded it. In one particularly telling video, the president calmly discusses with the leaders of the protest a demand to target STEM faculty based on the empty assertion that scientists are particularly prone to bias. In that same video, the president speaks of his plan for those who resist the new order. Bring them in, train them, and if it doesn't take, sanction them. He invites his partners to hold him to it. On the second day of unrest, the police chief called me. Rioters were stopping traffic and searching for someone car to car. The chief believed they were searching for me. She was worried for my safety and helpless to protect me, as the president had ordered her force to stand down. What would have transpired if the rioters had found me? I still don't know, and I strongly suspect they don't either. The protest at my class did not emerge out of the blue in May of 2017. 1 year earlier, I stood up and spoke in opposition to a dangerous proposal, one that threatened to establish a racial hierarchy amongst faculty. To those who have not faced something similar, this likely sounds hyperbolic. But one can now advance such policies and almost certainly succeed in passing them if they are properly draped in weaponized terminology. Equity, for example, has taken on special properties. If a person opposes an equity proposal, those advancing the proposal are secure in asserting that the person is motivated by opposition to racial equity itself. In other words, they are racist. My opposition to that first equity proposal was voiced to my colleagues with no students present. Demands for my resignation 1 year later, in May of 2017, were not the result of organic student confusion. They were payback for violating a de facto code of faculty conduct in which one's right to speak is now dictated by adherence to an ascendant orthodoxy in which one's race, gender, and sexual orientation are paramount. The students were on a mission. They were unwitting tools of a witting movement. This committee should take my tale as cautionary. Is there a free speech crisis on college campuses? One can certainly make that argument, but that portrayal is at least as misleading as it is informative. What is occurring on college campuses is about power and control. Speech is impeded as a last resort, used when people or groups fail to self-censor in response to a threat of crippling stigma and the destruction of their capacity to earn. These tools are being used to unhook the values that bind us together as a nation: equal protection under the law, the presumption of innocence, a free marketplace of ideas, the concept that people should be judged by the content of their character rather than the color of their skin. Yes, even that core tenet of the civil rights movement is being dismantled. Am I alleging a conspiracy? No. What I have seen functions much more like a cult, in which the purpose is only understood by the leaders, and the rest have been seduced into a carefully architected fiction. Most of the people involved in this movement earnestly believe that they are acting nobly to end oppression. Only the leaders understand that the true goal is to turn the tables of oppression. Something is seriously and dangerously amiss. At this moment in history, the center does not hold. Partisan polarization and political corruption have rendered government ineffective, predatory, and often cruelly indifferent to the suffering of American citizens. Tribalism is the natural result. Evergreen's public meltdown placed me in the eye of the storm and cast me into the spotlight. As a member of the intellectual dark web, I find myself at the vanguard of an emerging, non-ideological, non-partisan movement. Along with the Heterodox Academy and the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, we are fighting to restore civility and respect for competing perspectives. The electorate is starved for honest debate and for the good governance that follows from it. My advice to this body is to put the nation and its core values ahead of partisanship and join us in the center to end this cultish power grab and return us to a forward path as a nation. I look forward to your questions.
What has been the reaction to what happened to you, both on campus and off campus. Have any changes been made?
The campus has doubled down on every foolish idea it was pursuing and has gotten itself into very serious financial trouble for lack of students, which I should tell you, I warned my colleagues that if they pursued this false equity proposal, that that would be the result. So a rather predictable disaster is occurring on campus. I do want to push back a little bit, though, on the assessment that it is the left. Because really, it isn't one left. There is an ascendant orthodoxy on the left that is very troubling. It is quite broad, but I think not very deep. Then there's a concentrated mirror image of that on the far right, and both of these things are to be feared. The problem, though, is when you speak out on a college campus from a perspective on the left that does not fit this orthodoxy, you are immediately categorized as on the right, which makes it look that the left is monolithic and all shares this opinion, but it's not the case.
Dr. Weinstein, what happened in your classroom, which I've seen videos of, was your classroom that day a safe space or a free speech zone or neither?
Thank you for asking me that question. A safe space.
Didn't look like it was safe to me.
Well, I believe in something that could be called a safe space. But what safe space means to me as an educator is a space safe enough to take risks, which is roughly the opposite meaning of what is being invoked on college campuses. The answer to your question is that a free speech zone cannot coexist with a safe space because a safe space, by definition, according to this orthodoxy, is a place where you are free from being offended. So it cannot, it is mutually exclusive. But if you would allow me to, I feel that there's
in a safe space, could you say this sentence? Could you say, Donald Trump is president of the United States? Could you say that in a safe space on college campuses today?
Well, it depends which version of safe space you mean. If you mean a safe space the way it is used in common parlance on college campuses today, then the question of whether or not you can say it is contingent on whether or not somebody will be offended by that observation.
Now, think about that. You can't even state a fact, provable, right? I saw his tweet this morning. It's provable. He's the president, right?
Mr. Chairman.
You cannot do that. This shows the absurdity of what is going on campuses, and you have lived it in a physical way. Dr. Stanger has lived it in a physical way. This is what is scary. Dr. Stanger is raising her head. Mr. Weinstein, you have the floor, so you'd have to yield time to her.
Okay, the entire 15-minute talk is posted. I just wanted to share some of that because he was being, in all the video I saw, he was completely reasonable. His students love him. And what was interesting is the 50 students that attacked him also attacked his students. And we're calling him names and yelling and screaming. Here are some of the things now that they object to. They object to taking tests. They don't want to be tested. Okay. They object to having to come to class. So let me get this right. And this is exactly what they said. They feel that that it's racist to expect a person of color to attend class or to take a test. So, all right. So you will go to college, but you won't take any classes, you won't learn anything, but you can hang out and raise hell and be angry and show that everything in the world somehow threatens you, and you'll graduate. What kind of degree did you want, and what can you just choose any degree? Can you get a degree in physics and take no physics? When you open that door to such unreasonableness and from such immature people who know nothing about the real world, who've never had to participate in life at a level where they're responsible for cause and effect, where they've never had to see other people from other people's perspective. All they know is, I'm a victim of something, I'm a victim of everything, so anything you say or do that will cause a trigger reaction in me. And now we're making it real. We're trying to codify it in different laws and rules. President of the university, there was actually footage of him by his own students and every demand they made, and some were the most insane demands you can imagine, and someone had a cell phone, he said, okay, yes, I agree. What a coward. What a gutless coward. He shouldn't be running a university. Now, what's it say about the students who are there to learn, who are there to build a body of knowledge and skills that will allow them to take a productive place in society? It says that those students are going to be now considered not a part of the power directive. This is all about power. Those who 50 will have more power than 5,000 who say nothing, who are there for different reasons. But when you can demand that you don't want to take classes and you don't want to take tests, but you expect to get a degree, wow. And this is not an isolated situation. So it concerns me. And we should have a dialogue on this and say, what is the likely outcome of this? Because when a person feels that aggrieved about everything, then what exactly are they supposed to do in society? How are they supposed to solve problems? By condemning everyone who disagrees with them? Well, that sets you up for a really big pushback, because sooner or later, if you're really that tone deaf and that selfish, there's a whole lot of people in this country who've been watching all this insanity and saying, there's going to be a day when enough is enough. And I believe that that day is not far off. But when you're an academic and you stay silent, then you've got a problem. You're the problem. Stand up, other students, stand up and say it's not their university. It's an open university, so everyone should have an opportunity. If you want to come there to learn and be in that person's class, you have the right to do that. You don't need a safe space. You don't need a pillow to hug. You don't need a psychologist to counsel you after someone dared ask a question that you weren't prepared to answer. More on an upcoming show. I just want to mention that I just interviewed for over an hour this morning one of the upcoming panelists for this Sunday's 1 o'clock webinar. It's going to be a long one, by the way. We're going to also be premiering Deadly Deception in its entirety, the multi-award-winning documentary on vaccines. We have three phenomenal scientists. One is one of the best scientists in the world on genetics, and he's going to break down what's in a vaccine and how it impacts our DNA, especially the proteins that are in there. And another one's a clinician is going to be talking about every single vaccine is an assault against your biochemistry, because there's nothing in a single vaccine that your body needs or is benefited from. It's all there to hurt your body. So why in the world haven't we been honest about the toxicological effects of this? Also, I will be presenting on Sunday at 1 o'clock 167 scientific peer-reviewed articles proving unequivocally that vaccines can cause autism and other neurological dangers, not just the MMR vaccine. Go to GaryNall.com if you want to join us. It is really going to be a newsworthy program. It's going to be enlightening. Even if you're aware and up to date on vaccines, you're going to want to know the information we're sharing for hours on Sunday starting at 1 o'clock. Go to GaryNall.com. Otherwise, have a nice day, and we'll see you tomorrow.